Hi, this is Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out the podcast of Connecting Faith. Programs like this are made possible through the financial support of listeners like you. You can find out more or make a gift by clicking on the Support Faith Radio tab on the homepage. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hi, welcome to the broadcast. Really looking forward to today. It'll be a great discussion as we enter into Holy Week, and we're going to get some important perspective today. I just want to encourage you to stay tuned for that. But before we get to today's program, just want to mention we're excited about a new opportunity, a partnership with World Vision for the morning program, Faith Radio Mornings with Michelle and Ted. And for the next several weeks, we'll be focusing on the needs of children, an opportunity to sponsor children. In fact, I already had someone sign up today. We're excited about that. And when you go to our website, faithradionet.com, faithradionet.com, you'll see a link there right on the front page. It's talking about the World Vision sponsoring a child today. And so I encourage you to just check that out. And what I encourage you to be listening every morning to Faith Radio Mornings, of course, with Michelle and Ted. Tomorrow they're going to talk about that common Easter phrase, Christ is risen. He is risen indeed. Find out a little bit about the origins of that. I hope that you'll listen in and just to join in and to share the passion for children and child sponsorship. Check that out, Faith Radio Mornings, thanks to World Vision. By the way, I also want to remember, too, that if you have been thinking about there's someone that you're praying for this Easter season, you can call us at 877-93-FAITH and press 2 to get to our faith line and leave us a name there. We'd love to be able to pray for those friends of yours here in the days to come, and we'll focus on that, especially tomorrow. That's coming up. Well, welcome to Connecting Faith, and it is a very special time to focus on our faith, and we're happy to provide some perspective today and looking forward to spending a little time with my guest on the phone, Dr. Michael Rudelnik. He's professor of Jewish studies at Moody Bible Institute. We've had an opportunity to talk with him before. Son of Holocaust survivors. He was raised in an Orthodox Jewish home in Brooklyn, New York, and trusted Jesus as Messiah back in high school, and ever since has been ministering to the Jewish community. And we'll hear a little bit more about his stories. We talked together. He's written several books, including Understanding the Arab-Israeli Conflict, what the headlines haven't told you. And he was just recently in Israel, and so we'll spend a little time talking about that. But Michael, we want to spend some time today just getting to understand this week in our Christian calendar and understanding our the Jewish roots of our faith. And I guess particularly, let me just start with Passover, you know, maybe kind of a simple question. Does Passover always show up around Easter on our calendars? Are they related in a way that maybe we don't normally understand?
Well, let me first of all say thanks for having me on. I'm glad to speak with you for this season. And as to your question, generally they're around the same time. Passover and the resurrection season in the about the same time. It's just that Israel and the Jewish people, we operate on a lunar calendar, so Jewish holidays can sometimes come out like this year. Passover, first night of Passover, is on Good Friday, so they're right at the same time. However, sometimes they're as much as 2 or 3 weeks apart.
Okay. We need to understand, I guess, a bit more about Passover, and particularly, I guess, maybe even beyond that, a little bit more about the events that were going on when Jesus came into Jerusalem, and maybe we start with Passover and define what that is and the significance of this week that we celebrate.
Yeah, Passover is a celebration that's found in the Book of Exodus. That's where the events happened are recorded. The events that happened are recorded in the Book of Exodus about Jewish people being slaves in Egypt. We cried out to God. He sent a deliverer, Moses, who told Pharaoh, let my people go. Pharaoh refused. Of course, we know the story of 9 plagues. Each time Pharaoh doesn't relent, won't let the Jewish people go. And then the 10th plague is the slaying of the firstborn. And that plague, God said he would go through the land of Egypt, and the firstborn of every household would die. And then he gave a way of escape to the people of Israel. He said, take a perfect, innocent, spotless lamb, and then offer its blood, offer a sacrifice, put the blood on the doorpost of the house, God promised that when he passed through the land, he said, I will pass over you, where we get the name from. And then at that point, God was looking for the faith of the Israelites to do this. He does deliver them. The Egyptians let them go. And, of course, it culminates with the Egyptians changing their mind. The Pharaoh changes his mind, pursues them to the Red Sea. The Red Sea is parted, and then the Egyptian army is swallowed up in the Red Sea as it pursues the people of Israel as they fled. And so that's the essential story of Passover. It becomes the great deliverance, the great redemption of the Jewish people in Scripture. It's always repeated as the ideal deliverance, even end of days deliverance. If you think that Passover is great, think about how the end of days deliverance will be.
Well, let me ask you: is Passover still important today for the Jewish people?
Yeah, Jewish people. You know, Jewish people have been highly secularized and assimilated. For example, here in the United States, most American Jews are quite assimilated and not very observant. The great majority are not observant. However, surveys have found that most Jewish people do participate in a Passover Seder, a service for Passover in the home, a Passover meal. In some fashion, some way, Jewish people do observe Passover. It's one of the core holidays that even the most secularized Jewish people still participate in.
It was celebrated and remembered every year, right? Was it a week-long celebration?
It's 8 days. What happened after the deliverance from Egypt? God said, okay, every year you're to eat lamb, eat matzah as a reminder of what I did for you. The matzah is the unleavened bread. And throughout the generations, Jewish people have celebrated this meal. And, of course, there's traditions that have been added in terms of the celebration. And the Passover Seder is still celebrated. And, you know, the most observant Jewish people won't eat any bread, anything with leaven, for the week of Passover. It comes to 8 days, and it begins with two seders when we're here in the United States, two Passover meals at the beginning as we're in the dispersion. So there's two seder nights just to make sure we get it on the right night. In the land of Israel, there's only one. And it is a focal point for Jewish observance. It's so central. Now, most Jewish people in the States will not have lamb as a meal. There's two Jewish traditions. There's the Jews from the Mediterranean world, the Sephardim, and the Jews from the European world, the Ashkenazim. Well, the Ashkenazim don't eat lamb. We will eat brisket of beef or turkey or something like that. But Jews from the Mediterranean world will indeed eat lamb as a reminder.
You know, just we want to go back and help you, let you help us paint a little picture of what it would have been like Jesus coming into Jerusalem and being there, part of the Passover with the thousands of pilgrims streaming in. And but maybe just to, before that, talk about, you know, this is Passover is more than it was 8 days. Obviously, more than just a sort of 1 hour service on a Friday or Sunday like we typically have. So, give us a sense of maybe what each day was like. Was there a sense of kind of building toward a climax each day? Or?
Well, in the first century, there was an expectation of preparation for Passover. Your homes are not to have any leavened product in it whatsoever. So homes had to be cleaned. Probably this ancient tradition of Jewish people cleaning their homes for Passover became so prevalent that when Jewish people were spread around the world in the dispersion, most likely that's where people got spring cleaning from, because Jewish people would start spring cleaning their homes to get ready for Passover to make sure there was no leaven in it. So there's a building, a sense of anticipation. Then there's a ceremony just before Passover, the morning or 24 hours before Passover. It's searching for the leaven. You take a piece of bread, and you, after your house is all cleansed and ready for Passover, and you break it up into 10 pieces and hide it around the house, and then the family goes and with a candle and a feather and a wooden spoon, and we search for leaven, and we find those 10 pieces and collect it, and the following morning burn it. And it's symbolically saying, my house is cleansed of leaven, and I'm ready to celebrate the feast. And in fact, 1 Corinthians 5, Paul alludes to this ceremony when he says they were boasting about their tolerance of sin in Corinth, and And Paul said, your boasting's not good. Don't you know a little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough? Don't you know a little bit of yeast makes the whole bread unfit for Passover? Don't you know a little bit of bread in your household makes your whole house unfit for Passover? So he tells them, clean out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump. And then he says, for Messiah, our Passover has been sacrificed for us. And so when he talks about cleaning out, searching out the leaven, and then we can celebrate the feast, he says. And so it is probably an allusion to that preparatory cleansing of the home.
And was that something that was sort of established right at the time of Moses, or have things sort of been added to it?
But it's probably intertestamental. You start seeing the searching for the leaven by the first century. You know, it's hard to determine when traditions began because most of them were written down after the second century. So they reflect a tradition that predates the second century, but they were written down at the close of the second century AD. So as a result of that, it's sometimes hard to determine when the traditions began, but that since Paul is alluding to it, it probably was there since the generations before.
Well, you're listening to Connecting Faith, and we're connecting today with Dr. Michael Rudelnik, who's professor of Jewish studies at Moody Bible Institute, and we're getting some perspective on Holy Week, and particularly as we understand the Jewish roots of our faith, and talking about Passover, and we'll continue in a moment more with Dr. Michael Rudelnik. Look forward to having opportunity to talk with Dr. Rudelnik as we understand a little bit more about the roots of our faith, and we want to talk particularly as we are in Holy Week about the connection with Passover and what it would have been like in Jerusalem as the pilgrims were coming, Jesus coming into Jerusalem on a colt, the shouts of Hosanna. Just as I've read, Michael, it seems like there would have been thousands upon thousands of people. Would people have even noticed, Jesus coming in on a donkey, or would he just been, have a small group among many?
Well, the thing is that you're right. The Jerusalem would have been very crowded. First of all, people from all over the land would come for those days so that they could offer their Passover lamb sacrifice and they could celebrate this great pilgrimage festival at that time. In Jerusalem. And it wasn't just from all over the land of Israel. They were coming from all over the dispersion. People would make long treks to come to Jerusalem so that by the time you see Pentecost, people and the disciples are preaching at Pentecost. There are people who have been there since Passover, but they're from the entire Roman Empire. They're there, and they hear them speak in languages from their own area. So that's how we know from Acts 2 that they were coming from all over the empire. The Roman Empire, to the land of Israel. So it was, Jerusalem was packed. And it wasn't just packed with Jews. The Romans would see Passover as a time where there might be disturbances. So they moved troops, extra troops, to Jerusalem. And the Roman governor, by the time you come to the first century, which was Pontius Pilate, but the Roman governor would come and take up residence in the Antonia Fortress, which was a huge fortress built adjacent to the temple so that they could oversee, they have a good sight of what's going on at the temple, see if any trouble was brewing to make sure that that things would stay peaceful and quiet during the Pax Romana. They wanted to keep the peace. And so there was a great deal of a military presence in the city at that time, as well as Jewish people from all over the globe coming to Jerusalem to celebrate Passover. So it was very crowded. Now, your question is, who would have known Jesus? Now, it's not clear. Maybe Jesus coming down the Mount of Olives Road on a donkey stirred attention. Zechariah 9:9 says, behold, your king comes to you lowly and riding upon an ass. That was a verse that was clearly understood to be a messianic passage. So when you have someone riding down a donkey, a young foal, down this path from the Mount of Olives, heading towards the eastern gate of Jerusalem, which is where the Messiah is supposed to enter, obviously this would stir attention. It was making a very loud public statement. And that's when the crowd gathered and shouted, "Hosanna, Hosanna." That could be one of the reasons why it gathered attention. Another aspect that's possible is that in Daniel 9, verses 24 through 27, it gives a pretty technical prophecy of the coming of the Messiah. And I believe, finds its fulfillment. The 70 weeks of Daniel, there's 69 weeks from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, which was the decree of Artaxerxes in 444 BC. These many biblical years go by, and then the Messiah will come, until the Messiah. And I believe if you calculate that prophecy accurately and carefully, it comes out on Palm Sunday, AD 33, which was the date of the triumphal entry. And so it seems to me that that makes a lot of sense, that perhaps people were there for that. And in fact, Jesus says to them, if you had known this day to Jerusalem, the things which make for peace, but now they're hidden from you. So that could have been part of the reason for the great interest of this person coming on the donkey into Jerusalem.
Well, certainly there would have been those that would have, as you say, would have calculated correctly, because there was a great interest, wasn't there, in studying these things in great detail.
Exactly. They were looking for the Messiah. The first century was an exceedingly messianic time. There was anticipation of the Messiah's coming.
Is that because the city was so crowded? Is that why Jesus went back and forth from Bethany? And did people typically sort of they go out of town and sort of come in? Or
of course, that's speculative. But Bethany is just across the Mount of Olives. It's right there, so it wouldn't have been that'd be like saying we're here in Chicago and he was staying in Evanston. It's like staying in Chicago.
Okay.
So.
But there were.
I don't know. Where's your radio station based?
We're based in Minneapolis, St. Paul. So.
Okay, it'd be like staying in Rochester.
Yeah. Okay.
So.
And there would have been. Obviously, you said that some people would stayed till 40 days afterwards. I mean, there was.
Well, that's because the Pentecost was or Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks, is a pilgrimage festival. People would come for Passover, stay during the counting of the days up until the 50th day, and then celebrate Pentecost, and then they would go home. So you just didn't come. I mean, it wasn't a time of flight like we have, where planes take, air flight. We can go to Israel if we wanted and spend 8 days and then go home, and it's no big deal, which is what I just did. I spent 2 weeks, but nevertheless, you just come back. But back then, if you're going to make that big trip to Jerusalem, you might as well stay, because it took a long time to get there. You might as well stay through Pentecost, which was a pilgrimage festival, and then after Pentecost return.
Tell me a little bit about that that meal, the Last Supper that we call it. Was it sort of anything like we see in the pictures?
Well, I suspect that no meal ever has anyone sitting on one side of the table. I always think that's funny when you see the famous Da Vinci painting. I think there's a lot of errors in that painting. One of the things, everyone's sitting on one side of the table. Another is that they have these lovely fluffy loaves, which I love Italian bread, but you wouldn't eat that on Passover, and this was a Passover meal. Not only that, but they have fish platters out there on the table in Da Vinci's famous painting. Of course, at Passover, we would eat lamb. At least in the first century. And then the other thing is, I find it interesting that all the disciples are painted to look like Northern Europeans and not like Mediterranean Jews. Even Jesus looks like a Northern European in that painting. There's only one of the disciples that's painted, and he doesn't even look like a Jew. He looks like a Nazi caricature of a Jew, and that's Judas Iscariot. Leonardo thought that the only person that he could paint to look like what he thought was a Jew, although it was a terrible stereotype and not a true picture, but was the one who betrayed the Lord. But they were all Jewish, and they all should have been painted as Mediterranean-looking people. Nevertheless, there's a lot of mistakes in terms of what we think is going on. But I think when we picture the Last Supper, we don't think of it as a Seder very often, and we certainly don't think of it accurately. We think of it more like Leonardo's painting.
Yeah. And it was, that was in fact the Seder, right?
It was a Passover. The Seder, the word Seder means order or service. and it was the service of the Passover, which takes place in a home, not in the temple, not in the synagogue. A sacrifice was offered, and then the family would gather in a home. Jesus and his disciples gathered in an upper room, and they observed a Passover Seder. And it has all sorts of rituals as part of it, like special hand washing. Of course, instead of having his hands washed as the leader, Jesus goes and washes the feet of the disciples. He takes a tradition and turns it upside down to show how they should be servants. There's special seats. There's the seat of honor just to the right of to the left of the leader, and the seat for the youngest to the right of the leader. And, of course, we see that reflected in the New Testament. The disciples come into the upper room. They're arguing over who gets to sit where, who's the greatest in the kingdom. They want to know who gets the seat of honor. We find out later on who does have the seat of honor, because John, by tradition, who is the youngest of the disciples, leaning with his head on the breast of the Lord. Everyone leans left at Passover, so he would have been just to the right of the Lord, fulfilling that tradition of being the youngest. He sat to the right of the Lord, and Peter asks, who will betray the Lord? And it is relayed, Jesus says, the one to whom I offer the sop, which is probably ground-up horseradish. And, of course, the leader would take some of that himself as part of the ritual and then pass it to the guest of honor to his left, and that would have been the person who had the seat of honor. And Jesus says, the one who will betray me is the one I offer the sop to. So apparently Judas Iscariot is the one that got the seat of honor to the left of the leader. And it's really kind of amazing when we think about that, that the disciples arguing over who's the greatest, essentially they picked Judas, maybe because he was from Judea and not Galilee, maybe because he was the treasurer. I don't know why they chose him, but certainly it does show how man looks at the outward, but God looks at the heart. He was the son of perdition, and yet he was the one chosen to sit in the seat of honor. And so there's all these different rituals that were going on in the Gospels. We read about it that reflect it being a Passover Seder.
Just to clarify, why leaning left?
It's because we recline at meals. There's one of the four questions is in all the meals we sit upright, but at Passover we always recline. That comes from the Roman era, because Romans would recline to show their freedom. Free people would eat reclining, whereas slaves would stand and eat. And so to show our freedom, the tradition began lean left, to recline to the left, have a pillow to your left, to show that we have been made free by God. So that's the reason that you lean left.
Amazing insights, and we're going to get some more in just a moment. Stay tuned as we continue talking with Dr. Michael Rudelnik, professor of Jewish studies at Moody Bible Institute. He's written several books, including Understanding the Arab-Israeli Conflict, What the Headlines Haven't Told You. He's co-editor of the Moody Bible Commentary, served on the translation team for the new Holman CSB version of the Bible, and has been our guest in the past. He's giving us some great insights. We understand more about the Jewish roots of our faith. We'll continue in just a moment here on Connecting Faith. Let's take a minute to reflect on the bread and the cup with a little bit of Michael Card. Coming up in a moment, we'll spend some time talking a little bit more about that Seder and the four cups. Right now, a little bit of music from Michael Card. This is Connecting Faith.
Come to the table and savor the sight, the wine and the bread that was broken, and all have been welcomed to come if they might. Accept as their own these two tokens. The bread is his body, the wine is the blood, and the one who provides them is true. He freely offers, we freely receive. To accept and believe him is all we must do. Come to the table and taste of the glory, and savor the sorrow. He's dying tomorrow. The hand that is breaking the bread soon will be broken. And here at the table sit those who've loved him. One is a traitor, and one will deny, though he's lived
Thanks for joining us here on Connecting Faith. And on this Holy Week, we're entering into a discussion of a greater understanding about the events that took place in that that busy city of Jerusalem 2,000 years ago, and getting insight from Dr. Michael Rodelnik, professor of Jewish studies at the Moody Bible Institute. We were talking a little bit ago, Michael, about the Last Supper, the Seder. So that took place in the home. There was a sacrifice in the temple. You know, we don't really have a good hands on the sacrificial system. So talk a little bit about what it would have been like there, just with thousands of pilgrims. You know, it just seems like animals and all. It would have just been a state fair bazaar.
Yeah, it would have been amazing. And certainly people could bring their own lamb. Part of the corruption that was going on in that time was that, first of all, it had to pass muster, and there was they were especially stringent, and no animal hardly could be acceptable. Therefore, you had to buy one of the provided animals that they said was perfect. So it was a little bit of a business, and so, or other people would buy just because they had traveled so far and they wouldn't be able to bring an animal with them, but they would purchase an animal, and then of course you're not allowed on temple grounds to use regular money, so they would have to use temple money, so you'd have to go see money changers and convert the money so that you could buy an animal. And, of course, that's what the Lord got so distressed about, was the money changers who were operating there, turning his father's house into a den of thieves. And so it's sort of like a bazaar, like you say. And not bizarre, but a bazaar, like a Middle Eastern bazaar with buying animals and trading money and exchange rates and so forth, because you've got money coming from all over the empire. Okay, what's your – just like today, what's the exchange rate? And and so they were doing that, and then, of course, bringing it, offering it, and then having the slaughtered animal with all the blood and the mess. It becomes like a butcher shop there, and that's the animal that would be brought and eaten in the home as part of a Passover celebration.
As I understand, the temple was, I mean, it truly was the center of the city, or in terms of, I mean, the just the size alone, it would, whether you were a Jew or Gentile, it would have been the place where it was all happening, right?
Oh yeah, it was the focal point. It's on the highest point of Jerusalem, on Mount Moriah, and of course, Herod. By the time you come to the first century, what he had done is he had built this massive structure. It was so big he couldn't fit it on the top of the mountain, Mount Moriah, where Abraham had sacrificed to Isaac. That's where the second temple stood. And so what he did is he built out. He made a huge, like 3 football field size, flat top, and built retaining walls around it to keep it together. So it was a huge, huge complex on the highest point of the city. And, of course, had the glorious temple built right in the middle of this flat area that he had built up. And he wanted it to be one of the great wonders of the world, and it indeed was. So, yeah, it would have drawn a lot of attention. It's when you go to Jerusalem today, it's that area that catches your eye. There's a mosque and a Muslim shrine on top of it, the Dome of the Rock. But then it would have been the temple that drew your attention.
We talked about the Passover, about being a spotless lamb needed. Jesus was very clear about who he was, and self-defined himself. Those great I ams. Would people have? There would have been a great deal of question, wouldn't there, about, from the religious leaders about the statements that Jesus was making in terms of who he self-proclaimed to be.
Mm-hmm. He would have been clearly identifying himself when he came down on Palm Sunday. That was making a very loud statement as to who he was. I believe that was his presentation to Israel. This is for 3 years he's ministering, he's doing miracles, but he's not presenting himself to the nation as the Messiah officially. When he comes down that Palm Sunday Road, this is the official declaration to Israel that I am the Messiah. It's time to receive me. What's amazing, too, is that's the day that the Passover lambs would have been examined for sacrifice. to see if they were sufficient, perfect for offering. And so on the very day that the lambs were being offered to examine it for examination, so Jesus offers himself for examination to Israel.
What else do we need to know about this week so that we can enter into it more fully? We don't understand the sacrificial system really either, and just in many of the traditions, we don't.
I think what we'd have to do is really understand one of the key points of the Passover meal has to do with the cups and the dessert. Now, the way a Passover meal goes is that there are four cups based on the four I wills of Exodus 6, 3, and 4. And the first cup is the cup of sanctification. It means to set apart. It sets apart the festival from the rest of the year. Then there's a second cup that's filled again, and you drink a second cup. And that's a cup of plagues. It's when we use that cup to recall the plagues. We recite the 10 plagues and take a finger and take a drop out of the cup for each plague. And then a meal. There's also kinds of ceremonies there. But then a meal is eaten. In the ancient days, it was with Passover lamb. Today, as I said, most Western Jews do not eat lamb because there's no longer a sacrifice. But they would eat a lamb sacrifice, the lamb that had been sacrificed. They would eat that together then with bitter herbs, and they would eat the whole thing together. And then after the meal, which is a full meal, a bit of lamb was set aside so that the last taste on the palate was the lamb, to remember that. And then a third cup of wine, the cup of redemption. And then after that, some hymns of praise are sung, and the fourth cup of wine, which is the cup of praise, which looks for the day of the Messiah's coming and establishing praise for the Messiah's kingdom on earth. So, in knowing that, I think the focal point is why, and this is the question, is why does Jesus choose to do what he does about the Last Supper and the establishment of the Lord's Supper? So, here's the point about the cup after the meal. The little piece of lamb that was set aside. Jesus doesn't do that. He actually takes a piece of matzah after they had eaten and said, "This is my body, which is for you." And that's what he uses to establish the Lord's Supper. And he's the very first to use matzah as a replacement. And I always believe that symbols have meaning. It's not like some random symbol. The reason he chose matzah is that it is without leaven, leaven commonly being a picture of sin in the Bible. And so he is without sin. It is striped. It is pierced. And this is a reminder that he would be pierced through for our sins, that he would be striped by a Roman whip. And so he uses the matzah as a picture of his body. Now, what's so amazing is a very early tradition began with Jewish believers. What they would do is they would take a piece of matzah early on in the service, break it in half, wrap it in linen, hide it away, and then bring it back after the meal at the third cup. And they called it the afikomen. And then the tradition after the destruction of the temple, that tradition, without understanding its significance, made its way into traditional Judaism. Here's the significance. The matzah is broken, wrapped in linen, hidden, brought back at the third cup. And it's obviously a picture of the Messiah's death and resurrection. And that's the matzah that the early Jewish believers used for the Lord's Supper as part of their Seder. And they named it the Afikomen, the coming one. And now it's part of the traditional Jewish Seder. Jewish people do it. They say Afikomen means dessert. They have no idea that, except for some scholars, but they don't really know its roots are early in the Messianic Jews based on what Jesus had done at the Last Supper. And so that's just an amazing part of it. He was the first to use matzah instead of the lamb for that end of the meal remembrance. And then the second thing that Jesus did is he takes the cup, which is the cup of redemption, the third cup. And it's the cup that reminds us that God redeemed us through the blood of a lamb. And established a new covenant afterwards, the old covenant afterwards. And Jesus takes the cup and says, "This is the new covenant in my blood." He's saying, just as we were redeemed the first time with the blood of a lamb, and then God established the old covenant. So this is the new covenant which will be established through my blood. And so he points to the redemption in the past as the picture of his redemption that he is providing. And that's why he uses the cup of redemption. And I think it's so significant that at a Passover meal, everything on the table, whether there's parsley and there's bitter herbs and there's salt water, which represents tears, and the parsley represents life, and the bitter herbs represents the bitterness of slavery, they're all symbols, and we eat them. And they're symbolic at a memorial meal. And in the same way, Jesus takes the matzah and says, this is my body, and he takes the cup, this is the new covenant of my blood. No one there thought that he was saying that those mystically turned into his body or blood. They understood, this is a symbol of my body. This is a symbol of my blood, and we will eat it just as we have the Passover Seder as a memorial for what I have done. And then they sang a hymn, it says. Of course, in this Passover liturgy, it's time to sing praise psalms, Psalm 113 to 118. And then they have the fourth cup. The fourth cup is they have a fourth cup, and it's a time where we think about Elijah. We would go to the door, look to see if Elijah's there to announce the coming of the Messiah. And then if he's not there, we drink the fourth cup, which is the cup of praise that one day there will be a kingdom of God, a great banquet, a great Seder on earth when the Messiah comes. What does Jesus do? He leaves that fourth cup standing. He says, I won't drink that cup with you until I come into my kingdom. He, too, is reminding them that we do the memorial meal until he comes, because he's going to be resurrected and return. So the fourth cup is left standing as a reminder that we'll drink the other cup until he comes. And that's exactly what Paul writes. It's that we do these things. We show forth the Lord's death and resurrection until he comes. And so much of our Lord's Supper celebrations really is rooted in the Passover Seder.
Amazing discussion, and we'll continue in just a bit more with Dr. Michael Rudelnik, professor of Jewish studies at Moody Bible Institute. We're talking about Holy Week and Passover and understanding the richness of our faith and the symbols that are there. You're listening to Connecting Faith. This is Connecting Faith. Dr. Michael Rudelnik is my guest. And Michael, I'm thinking, just even as you were sharing just moments ago here, going through some of the symbols and the significance of that supper, how I'm reminded of those pilgrims walking on the road to Emmaus, and said, you know, didn't our hearts burn within us as we come to understand more fully? I mean, we, you know, as evangelicals, we really have missed out a lot on the significance of our heritage and our faith, haven't we?
Well, yeah, but I will say I love that passage about did our hearts not burn within us as he opened the scriptures for us. And what he was doing, when he did that in Luke 24, that when their hearts burned, was that he actually was showing them how the Hebrew Bible foretold the coming of the Messiah's death and resurrection and his glory to follow. And he was telling them, you should have understood this because it's all rooted in what the Hebrew scriptures foretell about the Messiah. And I bet you don't have this, but I actually have a new book out. And it's based on Luke 24, in a sense, because it's called The Messianic Hope. Hmm. Is the Hebrew Bible really messianic? And it's pointing back to showing how the Hebrew Bible foretells the coming of the Messiah. It's a little bit more academic, but it's a book that might encourage people to see that if you want to have that kind of divine heartburn that Jesus gave his disciples, it's to understand that the Hebrew Bible foretold the coming of the Messiah.
Somehow I wish that Luke would have added another word or another line or two there. Wouldn't you have loved to know the outline to that
message? Yeah. I guess you got to read the book for that.
Yeah, I guess maybe so. Maybe so. Well, tell me, I mean, Michael, is that the case today? I mean, shouldn't the Jewish people have maybe a better understanding? You were just there. Give us a sense of, you know, what's going on today in terms of maybe an understanding of Messiah, and does Easter mean anything to them?
Easter means, in Israel, for the most part, tourism. Hmm. A lot of Christians from all over the world come to Jerusalem, and Israel is happy to welcome them to celebrate the resurrection. Secondly, Passover is a great celebration in Israel. It's a remembrance of things past, of God's deliverance. And even secular Israelis participate in Passover. Some actually go around the world. They have some time off. But others, those who remain, celebrate Passover. There's family celebrations. But it's always looking backwards and not looking forwards. And in many respects, it's looking back to the past when God redeemed Israel. In many respects, they don't have any kind of sense of the link between Jesus, his disciples, the Last Supper, and Passover. It's shocking for them when they hear about that. I don't believe that there's a great messianic expectation in Israel as a general rule, although among the ultra-Orthodox, there's a lot of agitation at this point about the coming of the Messiah. Among the various sects of a group called the Hasidim, the ultra-Orthodox, you might see them with the beards and the hats and black hats, black clothing, side curls, things like that. They are the only ones in Israel that have a sense of messianic anticipation or expectation at this time. But there's a good deal of excitement for Passover every year. It's an amazing thing that even secular Israelis, most Israelis are quite secular, celebrate this festival because it's part of the cultural heritage of the Jewish people.
You know, we often talk about this season of the year is a time when, obviously, those that maybe only go to church at Christmas and then they come back at Easter. So,
yeah.
So there's maybe some greater interest in spiritual things.
I think there's a greater interest, and I think that whatever it takes is that it's rooted in history, and yet there is discussion about what God did, and there's a real love for the Bible, I believe, in the land of Israel because it's the heritage of the people. And I do think that there, as a general rule, there's greater spiritual interest in Israel, even among secular people, because of frustration with wishing that there would be peace, frustration with the failure of the peace process, and thinking, is there any way possible to find peace and satisfaction in life despite the tension we live in? There's the tension of what's going to happen with Iran. And I think that this causes Israelis to think more about spiritual things. And it gives a great opportunity for those of us who know the Lord and we're there, we can talk to them about spiritual things and finding peace in him and confidence in his love and protection.
So to develop a conversation with a coworker or a friend or neighbor, is there a direction or a thought, kind of a starter thought that you might recommend?
Oh, I always say that for me, the most important thing is to establish a good, warm friendship of love and concern and consideration. That's here in the United States or in Israel. Doesn't matter. And for me, I always find people are surprised because their anticipation is of a Messianic Jew is that we would not celebrate Passover any longer. And, of course, Passover is central to our celebration. My family, we celebrate Passover as part of our resurrection celebration. When we celebrate the atonement and what God has done for us, we do it on Passover. We celebrate redemption from Egypt, slavery in Egypt, and slavery to sin. And so when Jewish people find out that I, as a Messianic Jew, do this, they say, well, why do you do it? And it just opens the door. So I would say that anyone could do this. We can ask our Jewish friends, our neighbors, why they celebrate, or even ask our Gentile friends, why are you going to church this Easter? You want to come with me? Or what's the significance of it to you? And as we ask them questions, they will want to know what our perspective is as well. And so just a good, solid, caring relationship with questions about why we celebrate, what we celebrate, will open all sorts of opportunities for sharing our faith.
Well, let me ask you, our time is getting away, but just to in closing, you know, we celebrate and maybe don't always know why we celebrate. We look at this week central to our faith. What should we, are there, you know, one or two things that you say, this you must know, or if you understand this, it will make a big difference in how you approach this week?
I think the most important thing that we have to know is that most celebrations historically of the church have focused on Passion Week about the death of the Messiah. And yet, probably 20,000 Jewish people were crucified by the Romans. It was very normal. And if there is no resurrection, then Jesus was just one of those 20,000. I think that if we just talk about Jesus dying for our sins without a focus on the fact that he was raised from the dead, then he's just one of many dead Jewish people. The difference, the way that God proved that Jesus is God, confirmed his message, was by raising him from the dead. I think that we have to always remember that this is all about Easter. It's all about Resurrection Day. It's all about the Messiah being raised from the dead and fulfillment of the Scriptures. And this confirms that he is who he claimed to be, that he is God in the flesh, that he is the Redeemer. So if I could really encourage anyone, the most important aspect of this celebration is to remember that Jesus is raised.
Thank you, Michael. It's been a fascinating discussion. I want to mention the latest book. You've written The Messianic Hope, and there's also Understand the Arab-Israeli Conflict, what the headlines haven't told you. Sure, if people want to find out a little bit more about you and your ministry, I'm trying to remember the website. It's just your
name. MichaelRadelnik.com.
Yes.
That's it. It's hard to spell my name, but yeah. if you Google it, it'll come up. So RYDELNIK, MichaelRadelnik.com.
Michael, thanks so much. He's professor of Jewish studies at Moody Bible Institute, and always so encouraging and insightful to gain some greater understanding. We sure appreciate you, and glad you could take a little time today.
Great. Thank you so much.
And blessings to you in this Passover and Easter.
Happy Passover, sweet Passover, we say, and happy Resurrection Day.
And what is a sweet Passover? Is that there's no, it's bitter herb, so why are we talking sweet?
Yeah, but redemption brings sweetness.
Ah, wonderful.
So Aziz and Pesach.
All right. Dr. Michael Radelnik joining us today on Connecting Faith.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, I hope that you were challenged and informed by today's discussion. Glad to have you listening in. Tomorrow, we're going to spend some time talking about the hope of heaven. It's appropriate at Holy Week. Calvin Miller joins us to talk about his latest work. Tomorrow on Connecting Faith, we want to wrap things up right now with a song from Sherry Kagi.
This is my body given for you. This is the cup that holds the blood of a new covenant. This is forgiveness, simple and true. This is the way that I have made for you. Before you eat, before you drink, take a long look inside and tell me what you see. He said to me,